Today is Tuesday, March 2nd, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedor for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, COVID-19 cases on the rise globally.
I reported the virus was on a decline for consecutive 6 weeks, but first time in 7 weeks, we have a COVID increase.
Also, gunmen released 279 girls in northwestern Nigeria.
The shame is disgraceful. It is a slap to our faith as people, as a government.
Plus, US and UK condemn trial of Hong Kong democracy activists. These stories and more are next. The number of new coronavirus infections globally rose last week for the first time in 7 weeks, the World Health Organization said on Monday. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the rise in cases was, quote, disappointing, but not surprising, unquote, and urged countries not to relax measures to fight the disease.
In the past week, the number of reported cases of COVID-19 increased for the first time in 7 weeks. You remember that I reported the virus was on a decline for consecutive 6 weeks. But first time in 7 weeks, we have a COVID increase. Reported cases increased in four of WHO's six regions, the Americas, Europe, Southeast Asia, and the Eastern Mediterranean. This is disappointing, but not surprising. We're working to better understand these increases in transmission. Some of it appears to be due to relaxing of public health measures, continued circulation of variants, and people letting down their guard. Vaccines will help to save lives, but if countries rely solely on vaccines, they are making a mistake. Basic public health measures remain the foundation of the response.
That's WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. March 21st will mark a full year that the Canada-US border has been closed to all but essential traffic during the COVID-19 pandemic. Craig McCullough reports from Vancouver that a date for reopening the border remains elusive.
The Canada-US border is the largest undefended boundary in the world at 8,891 kilometers. There are 117 legal points of entry that have been closed to tourist and personal or non-essential travel for almost a year, resulting in an 80% drop in border traffic. For generations, travelers from both countries have easily crossed the border for vacations, shopping trips, and other excursions. That all stopped last March with the spread of the coronavirus. The only exceptions are for immediate family, those in long-term relationships, or for compassionate purposes. Those crossing for essential work or to transport commercial goods are also exempt. Suzanne Smith is in a unique position. She is the Canadian owner of Betty Be Good, two dress shops located just across the border in Washington State. Her stores employ seven Americans full-time. She lives on the Canadian side in suburban Vancouver, a mere two blocks from the border. Since the closure, her business has decreased 40%. As an essential worker, she can cross the border and does so once or twice a week. However, she can only go directly to her two stores and literally nowhere else, not even to a favorite eatery or to see her extended American family, unless they come to visit one of her stores.
It's really difficult when you straddle two sides of a border with your life. You know, you have restaurants that you enjoy, you have small businesses that you have supported over time, things that become part of your life. And, you know, I have family there as well. And, you know, a lot of people are in that boat where they can't see their family.
On February 22nd, the Canadian government increased the requirements for Canadians or permanent residents who are non-essential travelers returning home by land. Now, those crossing the border must show a negative COVID-19 test within the previous 72 hours or proof they had the coronavirus in the previous 14 to 90 days, therefore having at least temporary antibody immunity. Travelers will then have to quarantine for 14 days. Craig McCulloch, VOA News, Vancouver.
The U.S. State Department said on Monday that recent detentions and prosecutions of pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong show how the national security law imposed by Beijing is being used to stifle dissent. State Department spokesman Ned Price.
We call on the Hong Kong authorities to immediately release those still held and to drop the charges against them. Political participation should never be a crime. These individuals simply sought to exercise their rights by participating or helping others to participate in elections. This is yet another example of how the national security law is being used to stifle dissent, not to improve security. We continue to call on Beijing to stop undermining Hong Kong's autonomy and its democratic process, and to uphold China's obligations under the Sino-British Joint Declaration. When it comes to the people of Hong Kong, we continue to stand with them. We continue to stand with their aspirations for nothing more than the system that they have been promised.
That's State Department spokesman Ned Price. The United Kingdom also condemned the prosecution of pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong, a former British colony. British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab.
When China brought in the national security legislation, they were explicit this was being done to restore public order, not to crush political dissent. I think the actions, the prosecutions against such a large number of political opponents demonstrate that China is not keeping its word on Hong Kong. And it's given its word. It's given its word to the UK through the Joint Declaration International Treaty. It's given these assurances around how the national security legislation is going to be deployed and enforced. And I think it's incumbent, particularly on a leading member of the international community like China, for it to live up to its undertakings, its obligations, and to keep its word.
That's British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab. Police in Myanmar repeatedly used tear gas and rubber bullets against crowds protesting last month's coup. But the demonstrators regrouped Tuesday after each volley and tried to defend themselves with barricades as standoff between protesters and security forces intensified. At least 18 protesters died Monday when police fired on them. Also, a Myanmar court has filed two more charges against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi, her lawyer said on Monday. Suu Kyi is the longtime leader of Myanmar's pro-democracy movement, but her international reputation was tarnished when she defended the Myanmar's military bloody 2007 crackdown on Rohingya Muslims. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports on the charges against her.
Protesters in Myanmar were once again out in force on Monday, just a day after the deadliest violence reported since the coup. Yangon was littered with makeshift barricades, as riot police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse anti-coup protesters. While on the streets of Mandalay, a dozen kids chanted and marched against the junta. 18 people were killed on Sunday when police opened fire on crowds in various parts of the country. Monday marked the first funerals from the weekend's massacre. Myanmar has been in chaos since the military seized power last month. Citing election fraud, the army detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi and dozens of other political leaders. On Monday, Suu Kyi appeared in court via video conference and two more charges were filed against her. Her lawyer, Min Min So, told Reuters that she appeared healthy but may have lost some weight. Suu Kyi was charged under a section of the colonial era penal code, which prohibits the publication of information that may, quote, cause fear or alarm or disrupt, quote, public tranquility. Another charge was added under a telecommunications law, her lawyer said. Suu Kyi has previously been accused of illegally importing walkie-talkie radios and violating a natural disaster law. The UN is calling for the international community to put more pressure on Myanmar's military leaders. Several Western countries have already imposed sanctions. But Myanmar's generals have traditionally shrugged off diplomatic pressure with support from China and Russia.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. Nigeria President Muhammad Buhari says the release of 2,079 girls kidnapped from a school in northwestern state of Zamfara by gunmen brings him, quote, overwhelming joy, unquote, as the girls are reunited with their families on Tuesday. But critics say the government has failed in its responsibility to secure the country from bandits and kidnappers. For more, I reached public affairs analyst Abubakar Mohammed.
A shame. It is disgraceful. It is a slap to our face. as people, as a government, that children can no longer go to school and be safe. That they have a release is not something to say it is yet Uhuru. So their release doesn't mean as if we've made any achievement, because they were not rescued. It is one thing for them to be rescued. It is another thing for them to be released. When you say release, it's like the government delegation, both federal and state, entered into dialogue and negotiation with the representative of this very kidnappers. From what I heard, they said 10 bandits were co-opted to reach out to those who refuse to repent, who are still carrying out this very heinous act.
Some are saying that in negotiating with these terrorists and release of these girls, the government might be making the matter worse in future.
I totally agree with those who say the government is making the matter worse. Although I still sympathize with the government, because the public perception of the government, the international pressure of, you know, abandoning these girls or whoever that has been kidnapped in the hands of those kidnappers, I think it would make the government to be very unpopular. The UN is talking, the Pope has spoken. So many people have mounted pressure on the government to do all it takes to see that these girls, you know, were released. They have done that. It would backfire in the future. Those people who are equally thinking, if we go into this kidnap, we might be punished, will now say, okay, if we do it in a bigger way and make the government to be incapacitated, they would come and negotiate with us. And part of the negotiation would be that we will not be prosecuted or be tried. So it doesn't speak well. It is not a good thing. It encourages other people to do it.
The government is denying that money changed hands in securing the release of these girls. From what you know from your experience, do you believe that?
I, for one, does not believe it, because even the first one in Kankara, it was said that no money was exchanged, but later on we've had it, 30 million. And then at the end, they were saying the bandit were shortchanged, that it was actually 800 million there or so. So I understand the situation. Normally, there is no way they will come out and say money has been paid, so that other people will not be encouraged to go and still do it.
That's public affairs analyst Abubakar Mohammed. He spoke with me from Maiduguri. The UN Refugee Agency reports surging violence in northwest Nigeria this year has prompted more than 7,660 refugees to flee for safety into neighboring Niger's Maradi region. Lisa Stein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Wanton violence by armed groups and communal clashes in northwest Nigeria have been going on for years. But UN refugee spokesman Boris Cheshirkov says there's been an alarming spike in recent months. He says the number of violent incidents this year is higher than the number recorded for all of last year.
Refugees describe gruesome murders, kidnappings for ransom, and looted villages. Many have also been caught up in clashes between farmers and herders, as well as vigilantism. Self-defense groups are being set up in most villages. People fleeing are in urgent need of water, food, shelter, and health services. Most have fled empty-handed in a rush to save their lives.
However, the safety they have found is of a tenuous nature, as the Maradi region in southern Niger is itself extremely unstable. Cheshikov says the region hosts nearly 100,000 internally displaced people. He says rising violence inside Niger this year has forced 3,500 Nigerian citizens to flee their homes.
UNHCR teams in Niger have recorded a spike in deadly violence inside Maradi itself, with more casualties and serious incidents reported in January and February 2021 than in the whole of the second half of 2020. This is one of the reasons why we're working with the Nigerian authorities to relocate people away from these border areas.
Since 2019, Cheshikov says some 11,320 refugees have been relocated to other safer villages where basic aid and services are available. He says UNHCR and partners also have been better able to provide critically needed relief, including water, health, sanitation, and education for the displaced and their hosts. This, he says, has eased the pressure on local communities who themselves suffer from limited means. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. The Committee to Protect Journalists is urging Ethiopian authorities to free journalists and media workers detained in the region of Tigray, where government troops and their allies are battling forces loyal to the local administration. At least four media workers assisting members of international media have been detained in Mekelle, the capital of Tigray, in recent days. The European Union's top court has ruled that Poland's new regulations for appointing judges to the Supreme Court could violate EU law. The ruling on Tuesday obliges Poland's right-wing government to discontinue these regulations. The ruling was in response to a query by Poland's top administrative court to the European Court of Justice. An international media rights group has filed a complaint with German prosecutors against Saudi Arabia's crown prince and four other top officials, accusing them of crimes against humanity on allegations they were involved in the killing of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Tine Dolfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The African Bar Association wants U.S. President Joe Biden to stop the extradition of a Colombian businessman linked to Venezuela's government who has been held in Cape Verde since last year. The association says Alex Saab was acting as an envoy, the Caracas government, so his arrest is a violation of international law. Mike Mbonya reports from Lagos.
Hannibal Owaifo, the president of African Bar Association, says Alex Saab's detention is illegal.
So we are therefore appealing to President Joe Biden to get a critical look so that it doesn't appear or America should not be made to be seen as engaging countries to procure illegal activities on his behalf. Ambassador Saab is a diplomat accredited to the African Union, and extraditing to the United States against the core principles of diplomatic immunity and also the bare fact that Cape Verde do not have a extradition treaty with the United States.
Saab is a Colombian businessman with close links to the government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. International analysts and the United States government say he has long been involved in businesses alleged to have helped Maduro loot the country's resources and revenue. In July 2019, the U.S. charged him with money laundering. He's also considered a fugitive from Colombia, where he faces similar charges. Saab was arrested in June 2020 when he made a stopover in Cape Verde while traveling to Iran to negotiate an oil deal for Venezuela. His lawyers have argued that since he was working on behalf of the Caracas government, he has diplomatic immunity and should not have been arrested. In addition, Venezuela has appointed Saab its representative to the African Union. In January, a Cape Verde court ruled he could be extradited to the United States, although Saab's attorneys are appealing and challenging the case against him in U.S. courts. Owaifo told journalists that Saab's wife wrote to the association about their plight, and he said the association's investigation showed their detention violates international laws and the protocols of the Economic Community of West African States. He said the association has reported the matter to the African Union and the Cape Verde government, but has gotten no response. Owaifo said the Bar Association will call for sanctions against Cape Verde for illegally detaining the ambassador.
Well, the options left for the African Bar Association at this stage is to, first and foremost, we want to engage the leadership of the African Union and ECOWAS. And then, of course, call for very serious comprehensive sanctions on the Cape Verde because of the illegal activities being carried out. Because I do not believe that all these actions can be justified by merely saying they were doing so on behalf of the United States. Because the United States is not doing anything now at this period in a positive manner to show that it is pushing Cape Verde to engage on this illegal act.
Venezuela's government is accused of widespread human rights abuses and extensive corruption. The United States, the European Union, and other countries have imposed economic sanctions on Venezuela and many officials in its government. Last month, United Nations human rights experts urged the Venezuelan government to stop what they called continuous and increasing attacks on civil society groups and the opposition. The experts also called for an end to economic sanctions on the country, saying they worsened Venezuela's deepening humanitarian crisis. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy was sentenced Monday to 3 years in jail on charges of influence peddling and trying to bribe a judge. He's appealing the verdict, but he has plenty of other legal troubles ahead, as Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris.
Monsieur Sarkozy? Monsieur Sarkozy? Former President Nicolas Sarkozy ignored reporters' questions as he left a Paris courthouse Monday. He becomes only the second modern French leader to receive a prison sentence. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was handed a year suspended sentence in another corruption trial. But Sarkozy faces a much stiffer penalty, 3 years in prison, two suspended, on charges of seeking to bribe a judge for information. The prosecution based its case on wiretap conversation between Sarkozy and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog. The judge and Herzog were also found guilty. Sarkozy maintains he is innocent. Even if he loses an appeal, he may not have to go to jail, but rather have the choice of wearing an electronic bracelet. He faces plenty of other legal woes, however, including allegations he received millions of dollars from former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to finance his 2007 election campaign, 2011 campaign spending questions, and possible influence peddling linked to Russia after he left office. A staunch conservative, Sarkozy succeeded Chirac as president in 2007, but served only a single term before being defeated by socialist François Hollande in 2012. He also lost another presidential bid in 2017, but saw his popularity rising sharply since announcing his retirement from politics a year later. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
For the first time in Australia, teenage activists have launched a class action lawsuit on behalf of young people around the world to stop a large coal mining project 430 kilometers northwest of Sydney. A trial started Tuesday in the federal court in Melbourne. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The campaign to take the Australian government to court over coal mining was prompted by the Black Summer bushfires that burned from mid-2019, which was Australia's driest and hottest year on record, to March 2020. They were the most intense fires ever documented in Australia. The teenage plaintiffs insist Environment Minister Susan Ley has a duty to protect them from global warming. They argue the expansion of coal mining in the state of New South Wales will worsen climate change and harm their future. One of the claimants, 14-year-old Izzy Raj Seppings, wants to inspire other young people around the world.
Hopefully it empowers everyone to keep fighting for climate justice. I think our case shows people all around the world that if you fight hard enough, your voice can be heard, and that this struggle for climate justice isn't over yet, and there's still so much we need to accomplish.
The claimants are younger than 18 years of age and are supported by a so-called litigation guardian, Sister Bridget Arthur, who's an 86-year-old nun. The class action lawsuit could set a precedent that stops Australia approving new fossil fuel projects. The coal mining company involved said the teenager's case has no merit and should be dismissed. It said in a statement that 450 jobs would be created by the multi-million dollar project. The resources firm insisted major employment generating investments that would boost Australia's recovery from COVID-19 shouldn't be delayed by legal claims that have no substance. Legal experts believe that given the complexity of the case, stopping a major mining project won't be easy. Coal generates much of Australia's electricity and is one of its biggest exports. Its longer-term future, though, is uncertain because of a global shift to renewable energy. The Federal Environment Minister has agreed not to make a final decision on the expansion plan until the trial is over. The hearing in the federal court is expected to last for 5 days, but a judgment may not be delivered for several months. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mark Barrow, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20.